Seattle Kitchen Show. I'm Chef Tom Douglas.
And I'm Katie O.
And you're Katie O. Welcome here. We're here at the Hot Stove Society. I'm chef owner of many of Seattle's fine restaurants. Our buddy Terry is somewhere in the ether, making his way our direction.
Through traffic.
But we couldn't wait for him any longer. For those of you who don't know, we tape on Tuesday mornings here at the Hot Stove. Fun, come buy a ticket.
That's right.
Go to hotstovesociety.com. It's only $15. We have a big show for you today. We always talk food and wine and sometimes beer when Tina puts a beer event together. Today we're going to talk celiac a little bit, right?
We are, yeah. An important issue for some people. 1 out of 100 people have celiac disease. So I found a great restaurant where they can eat comfortably.
Comfortably and delicious, right?
And deliciously, yeah.
Exactly. Your culinary quandaries, as usual, Katie and I will take those on and hammer home some answers to very important questions.
Mm-hmm.
We're going to talk chocolate with Bakery Nouveau owner William Lehman. We're whipping up some Father's Day treats with pastry chef Brittany Bartleben. I saw her yesterday and said, why do we not have those delicious strawberries, the Washington strawberries, first of the season, on the menu right now in the Dahlia Bakery?
They are so good.
Behind her back, she pulled out, she was just bringing the first batch to the pastry.
Well, there you go. So. Do you feel like some sort of dessert with strawberries is a Father's Day-like dessert?
Well, for me, a tradition has always been that we would go over to Eastern Washington, is why we ended up with a farm in Prosser. To me, we would always pick cherries for Father's Day. That was more of a traditional ripening time for Washington cherries. And then there also was quite a bit of red wine release time over there. So we drink red wine, pick some cherries, and then we fell in love with Prosser, and that's why we have a farm there. Now, so.
I feel like you really understand how to do your own holiday, Father's Day.
Yeah, exactly. Of course, we're going to go toe-to-toe on food trivia at the end of the show.
Mm-hmm.
Nikki from Cuoco is here to talk about our rosé party. Ian Jeffers is here from Pen Cove Mussels. We have a jam-packed show, so I'm going to shut up and let you get started on the questions.
That's right.
How to make ordinary go to extraordinary.
That's right. This is ordinary dishes made extraordinary. And lately what we've been doing is looking at the national food holidays because there is essentially one for every day of the week, it seems. So
every day?
Every day. So let's talk about this weekend. We've got Corn on the Cob Day, National Corn on the Cob Day on the 11th.
Not going to talk about it.
You refuse because it's too soon, right?
It's too soon. That's not corn time.
I know.
We just got our first strawberries.
This was really just an excuse for you to get upset about talking about corn too soon. All right.
I'm putting my foot down.
Put it down.
I have my ear to the ground on what day this is.
Well, you know what else is that day? German Chocolate Cake Day. Do you want to get mad about that too?
Let's talk about that.
Okay, let's talk about that one.
Why are you laughing?
Sarah's laughing.
Do you like German chocolate cake?
I can't even tell you the last time I've had a slice of German chocolate cake.
My grandma used to make it all the time. That little coconut frosting, right? And kind of a chocolate powder, I would say, more than like a dense devil's food cake. It's just a lighter kind of chocolate cake.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm somewhat glad I don't have to eat it anymore.
Why is that?
Because she died. Yeah.
No, but I mean, like, why are you glad you don't have to eat it? We can talk about the finer points.
It was never my
favorite
cake. She made so many good things. Like, I would much prefer her butterscotch pie with meringue, or she made great lemon bars, and she was a terrific devil's food cake maker with a little bit of that sour cream, buttercream on top.
That's delicious.
That's what I used to have for my birthday cake.
I'm sure, people out there that like a German chocolate cake. Is there a way that even the non-German chocolate cake lover can get into it by something a little more extraordinary?
Make a French chocolate cake.
No,
I really don't know of a way. So this was an entirely wasted segment.
Okay, well, maybe we'll talk to Brittany when she's on
I think that's
later.
A good idea.
Let's finally get to two things that I know that you're very fond of. We've got National Jerky Day coming up, and we've also got National Strawberry Shortcake Day. We just talked about those delicious strawberries. Mm-hmm. I know I went to Met Market and have in my kitchen right now the most beautiful, fragrant, fruity little strawberries.
You shouldn't be in the fridge.
No, they're on the counter.
Oh, okay, good. Because that's a good way to kind of mush them out.
If
they get kind of grainy and they dehydrate because there's so much air always moving in the fridge, so they dehydrate and they're just not good.
Well, it's always that nice rule of thumb. Like, however it's situated in the produce section should be essentially how it's situated in your household.
Exactly. Yeah. So I love fresh herbs with my shortcake. So maybe something like a black pepper and brown butter shortcake.
Mm-hmm.
So you've got a little spice, a little depth of flavor with the brown butter. And then in my strawberries, I like things like anise hyssop, mm-hmm. or even if you want to get really fruity and fragrant.
Fragrant.
then you can put some lavender in there or lilac blossoms, something of that sort.
Mm-hmm.
But I like that kind of when you start to take that aromatic and play on that.
I also enjoy
And then
that.
Maybe orange zest, you know, in the strawberries. Things to kind of just brighten and make it pop.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Bring out all those various flavors in those beautiful, beautiful Washington strawberries.
I do think that a fresh sliced strawberry, you know, so often we're told, let them macerate on the counter and all that. I think you can overdo that. I think they get kind of, especially with things like Grand Marnier, and they get kind of wimpy.
That to me feels,
that
feels like a trick that you would use for slightly out of season strawberries, is like that maceration and all mm-hmm. those different flavors and letting it kind of sit and soak. Because most of the time, I would say strawberries are fairly flavorless, to be totally honest.
Well, yeah, because people are buying them in December.
That's right. Yeah. But this time of year, they are perfect. So that's what you want to do. All right, Tom, what about jerky? I know you love a little beef jerky.
I do. I've been eating. Do you have a brand that you like to buy? I've been eating a brand called Chef's Cut.
I don't know about the Chef's Cut.
Yeah.
Is it a softer style jerky?
Mm-hmm.
Mm. Is that your preferred preferred jerky on the market?
When I eat jerky, I don't snack on it. I eat the whole bag.
It's like a meal replacement. Yeah.
Because I'm traveling or for some reason I want protein instead of sugar or something like that. But I like a little bit softer. I like it. Some of them are just so salty, like those steak bites you can buy at Costco or something. Mm-hmm. Those to me are too salty.
Too much.
Yeah.
So now tell me, do you ever make your jerky as a jerky connoisseur?
We just made jerky here at the hot stove. We had a whole class on it. And we had the guys from Cle Elum come over, Owens Meats.
Oh, that's a very popular jerky stuff.
Yeah, they led us through a jerky class and, cutting up the top round, nice thin layers.
Mm-hmm.
I was surprised that they didn't trim as much as I expected. I was surprised they cut the beef a little thicker than I expected. And I was surprised that Sean's telling me we have to wrap this up.
Oh, well, there you go then.
All right. Up next, we're answering your questions on mayonnaise, camping, morels, and maybe we'll finish the jerky conversation on Cairo Radio 97.3 FM. Welcome back to the Seattle Kitchen Show. I told you Mr. Rossereau was going to force you to clap, and sure enough, he did. The chef in the chapeau has shown up through dense traffic. Thank you.
Oh, man, yes. That was heavy traffic.
It was done. It's done now. We tape on Tuesday, so while you're listening to this, it's wide open downtown. Please come join us.
Well, right now it's wide open, yes.
Chef?
How you doing, Tom?
Good. We were just in a discussion about beef jerky. I'm not sure if you have something to add, but before the break, I was going off on beef jerky, how lovely it is, what a nice product it is.
Well, I'll leave you alone on that one. I'm glad I wasn't here for that segment.
I was saying was, and we'll get back to that. I'm Tom Douglas.
I'm Katie O.
Yeah, and the chef in the chapeau. What I was saying was that top round, slice it a little thicker than I was thinking it had to be shaved, but it's really not shaved at all because the dehydration just really takes it
thins
to a nice
it out.
Spot.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And marinated overnight, something very salty.
You can put it in a dehydrator.
It only took one day.
Really?
Yeah, we did the process here in the class at the hot stove, the jerky class. Sliced it all, marinated it for one day, then the next day we put it into the dehydrator, and then it was done.
The dehydrator here all the time? Can I come and borrow it and make a bunch of jerky?
Yes.
Okay, cool.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Great. That's my question. But now I think we should move on to questions from our listeners on Facebook. This is where we go to our Facebook page, Seattle Kitchen, and if you have a question for any of us, even Tina Knoll, our producer, maybe even Sean, they don't get asked questions often, but I'm sure they'd love to answer them. Too.
Like, how much do you love working with us?
Oh my gosh, so much.
So much. That was an easy question.
How many weeks can you put that in the fridge?
All right, let's jump into it. The first question comes from Janelle Tremaine, and she says, question, I have had a gastric sleeve procedure, so I can't eat much at any given time. I often order appetizers as my main course, but sometimes I get the feeling that the server is annoyed at me. What is the etiquette for ordering in restaurants? Should I order an entree and just take home leftovers?
Fire the server.
Yeah, you fire the server.
Fire the server.
No, you just call the manager over and say, listen, I think I've disappointed my server. Could I have a new server, please?
Do you really think? I don't know that
if
people
If you're
are...
getting any sort of bad vibe, you're always welcome to ask for a new service.
I just don't know that people are going to feel... well, I guess we'll ask Janelle. Janelle?
Here's what just happened to me. I was on a golf course in Scotland. My caddy came up, and she didn't... She basically didn't even say hello. Hmm. Next thing I know, I'm carrying my clubs over to the first tee, blah, blah, blah. I get to the first... My first shot, she tells me it's 250 yards... was really only 170 yards. And then on the second tee, I just said, here's your 50 pounds, 50 British sterling, and goodbye.
Goodbye.
And she walked back to the clubhouse, and she was gone.
Yeah.
I carried my own bag.
I think there's something very interesting that happens, though, as a customer when you're in a restaurant, even if something you know internally is going wrong. Like, I've had this. Mm-hmm. You know, I've worked in restaurants, mm-hmm. so I understand proper procedure. I still get very nervous around putting someone out.
I agree, and I know exactly what you're saying, and I'm not taking it lightly.
Yeah.
Yeah, a lot of people, most people would not be comfortable with that. Mm-hmm. In our restaurants, obviously, there's a service charge, mm-hmm. and so what you do at the end of it is just say, you know what, the service wasn't there. And even for us, what we say is, well, no, not good service, you don't pay for anything. You don't like,
right.
you know, even if you loved your dinner, you're not mm-hmm. paying for your dinner because mm-hmm. your service wasn't there.
Yeah,
and you don't pay for the service either. So
right.
it's 100% refund, and maybe that's when you'd be more comfortable taking care of it.
I think so. I think that's oftentimes why you get...
Yeah, I'm 100% with you, Tom. I mean... You know, the number one thing is your server is not good and is not receptive to what you want, and that's absolutely a no-no. They make enough money doing that. There shouldn't be a reason why you're ordering an appetizer as an entree to have any beef with that.
Yeah, it doesn't matter.
Right. That's what I'd say. There's a lot of times I don't have... like anything going on with me, but you know, I'll just order appetizers.
I have never seen that.
What are you talking about?
You are a heavy eater.
Yeah, I do like to eat. You might be right, actually. Yeah. Okay, moving on.
I could use a gastric sleeve over my entire body.
I could use two.
All right, the next question comes from Jean Parton Russell, and she has a 3-part question. I've made homemade mayonnaise several times. This time I spaced out adding all the ingredients at once. Using my stick blender, I knew immediately I'd have to start over. Second try was successful. So here's the first of the questions. Tell me why adding all the oil spells mayo failure. I think she means
all at once. It's called an emulsion, which is egg yolks and oil. And if you go too fast, you oversaturate the egg yolk, which means all the oil will stay separated.
Okay.
How's that?
And, you know, you also add your mustard in the beginning, too. That helps the emulsion. So.
Mm-hmm. Two, does added lemon juice make raw egg safe?
Not unless you put a hell of a lot of lemon.
Yeah, I wouldn't think so, but I don't know that.
Yeah.
No. Does it? So, in other words, does it kill
pathogens
whatever?
Or whatever?
Yeah, E. coli or whatever. I doubt it.
Keep it stable. And then she says, what can be done with failed mayo? I liked this.
Well, the only way you can save a mayo that's been broken or separated when the fat is separated is to use Dijon mustard. Take a big spoon of that, put it in a bowl, and then slowly incorporate back all your product from your mayonnaise into that.
So, you know, and I would actually add another egg yolk, too, to the Dijon and start over. So.
And just have double the amount of mayo, perhaps.
Yeah. And it lasts fine in your fridge, so that's not a problem.
Okay, great. Mary Palmer wants to know ideas for quick, at least semi-healthy things to keep on hand to cook, prepare when you don't really feel like cooking. Maybe neither Tom nor Terry ever have this issue. Ha ha.
Well, eggs are an easy thing to have on hand.
Mm-hmm.
They last well in the fridge. I always keep smoked salmon on hand.
Cheese.
I love a little smoked salmon toast or
some semi-hard cheese. You know, soft and hard cheese.
Yeah.
I mean, those are very easy component to have in your fridge for quite some time without going bad. So mm-hmm. you can have those on hand. You know, back to the eggs. You should always have some eggs in your fridge. A dozen of eggs is not a lot of eggs. But making an omelette is like one of the easiest things in the world. And you can put so many things in that omelette. Anything you have, like smoked salmon. You can put some cheese. You can put some broccoli. You can put anything you want. So I think it's a good thing to have in your fridge.
Also, Mama Lil's peppers.
I was going to say peppers and pickled things are always great to have around. And then I think of the two of you, as we're coming into grilling season, your idea of always utilizing the grill when it's on. So like making a big batch of grilled vegetables
and having that
for the remainder of the week to pull from.
And don't forget, I mean, I just wrote my newsletter on this. If you want to get our newsletter, go to tomdouglas.com. But I just wrote it about, I just literally pulled a frozen rack of lamb out of the freezer, oddly. And I put my Chinese rub on it, frozen solid, put it into a pan, gave it a quick sear, and popped it into a 500-degree oven and had delicious rosy pink rack of lamb.
Yum.
20 minutes later.
Just
from
like
a
that.
Frozen solid rack. So don't be afraid to cook from frozen, whether it's a New York steak, an Italian sausage, a rack of lamb.
Mm-hmm.
It works beautifully. And if you want, you can look at Kenji Lopez Alt's book.
Love that book.
And it'll talk all about that.
Right.
And really, there is no, there's not a lot of difference between doing it from, you know, we always see,
you
pull
just
it
have
out
to make
the fridge,
sure it's
right,
warmed
let it
up.
Temper. That's just not the case.
Okay, I have one really quick question because we only have like 1 minute left. It's from Maria, and she wants to know, what is pickling spice?
It's allspice,
coriander,
chili,
peppercorn,
fennel seed, peppercorn.
Some people put cinnamon stick in there for some reason or another.
Yeah, I don't know.
I'm not a big fan of that.
That's about it, I think.
Yeah. There you go.
Bay leaf,
that's right. Don't forget the bay leaf. Up next is William Lehman of Bakery Nouveau. He's going to stop by with a new chocolate project he's excited to share on Cairo Radio 97.3 FM. Welcome back. It's the Seattle Kitchen Show on Cairo Radio.
Look at that. You give them free chocolate, they start applauding.
I know, exactly. You didn't even have to prompt them that time because they're so excited. Before we get started with William, I want to give a little plug to for my wife's class here at the Hot Stove Society on the 21st of June. It's called Give Bees a Chance. We need plants, and plants need bees, and bees need us. We're going to get kids buzzing about pollinators and give bees a chance by raising funds to support local schools with educational beehives. There's 250 schools still waiting for hives, so this money that we raise at this event is going to help with that. And thanks to the generosity of Cascadian Farm and Wholesome Harvest, the Whole Kids Foundation is making great progress towards that goal. So it's the National Pollinator Month in the month of June, and we're going to highlight the importance of pollinators to our gardens, agriculture, and the food we eat. Through five nationally acclaimed chefs, sponsors Cascadian Farm and Wholesome Harvest, and individual donors, the goal is to raise $100,000 with 100% of those funds generated supporting educational honey beehives for schools and nonprofits across the nation. So, again, that's the 21st of June here. The Hot Stove Society class with Jackie Cross, my wife, and farmer-in-chief of Prosser Farm. Time is 6 to 9 p.m. $125 is the donation. And it's going to be an interactive dinner and with welcome cocktails and wine pairings.
Wow.
So, shoo.
Sounds fun.
Yeah.
And also, you get to hang out with your beautiful wife, Jackie Cross. That's pretty awesome.
Exactly.
And you get to save the bees.
And you get to save some bees.
So it's under the Give Bees a Chance Seattle Dinner 2018.org.
And if I'm right, the 21st of June is the first day of summer, the longest day of the year.
Longest day of the year. Exactly. Bees will have plenty of what they like to pollinate.
No, but my point is, if you come to this dinner, it's going to be the longest party of the day, the year.
Exactly. It's a solstice party.
Yeah.
Yeah. William Lehman is here of Bakery Nouveau. He's got a new chocolate project that he's excited about, and apparently the entire audience is excited, too, because he brought you all chocolate.
We don't get that kind of applause, man.
Yeah.
We've all of a sudden become the Oprah show.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I charge him for breakfast. William brings him free chocolate.
I'm just here for the friends.
That's right. So tell us what's going on with your new chocolate project. It looks very organic.
We're finally getting the new, the third location open in Burien. That's always been like the ultimate goal in having a place where I could have a little laboratory, if you will, of mm-hmm. making chocolate from the bean. And then
the mad scientist you are is at
play. Exactly. But, after 30 years in the industry and working with so many different types of chocolates, chocolate has always been that number one goal as a pastry chef to get to that point where you're making your own. Yes,
wow.
It's great to make candy when you work with other master chocolatiers. They'll all tell you the same thing. I'm not in it for selling the chocolate. I'm in it for selling you the fillings. Well, I'd like to sell you both because, with chocolate, it's people ask, why chocolate? And in my mind, I'm thinking, well, honestly, it's one of the top ingredients, when I think about it, it's really a labyrinth of endless possibilities.
Mm-hmm.
You can put it on toast. You can put it in a tart. You can put it in your coffee. You can eat it on its own.
I mean, it's like, huckleberry sauce to go with duck last night.
Yes. I mean, what can't you do with it? And with there being over 600 volatile compounds in chocolate, I think we've just not even begun to scratch the surface of how good it really is for us.
Mm-hmm. That kind of answers my first question, which is, you know, there's very well-known candy makers around that don't make their own chocolate, Franz being an example. Theo, of which I'm an investor in out in Fremont, does make their own chocolate, right?
Yes.
So what are you going to do different?
I'm going to do what I want.
That seems like a nice way to approach it.
That sounds like, you know what? That sounds like the beginning of a very successful story. Because when you do what you want in life, usually it comes out really good.
And you know, and I was thinking about this last night. I was like, I don't know how you guys do it. Especially you, Tom, with your restaurants and your bakeries. It's like, it's hard work doing what you want.
Yeah.
How do you make a choice?
Yeah. Well, that's why I have so many different flavors of my restaurant.
Just yes.
Doing one variety of food just didn't interest me. I always liked the idea of doing whatever you wanted.
It's maddening how one thing leads to another idea, and it just doesn't stop. It's a sick, vicious cycle, and it's wonderful.
So what is it that you're looking for in the chocolate that you're making? Since, you know, again, there's other products out, but in this particular instance, you have control over the entire process. So where does it begin for you?
Really good chocolate can be great if it's handled correctly, and that all starts with the farmer. And a lot of that has to do with information that they get or they are helped with. And for me, sourcing beans is a great place to start. And for us, we really want to make sure that we're working with farmers that are using sustainable practices, because as we get further down the road here, we're going to run into some problems, because as other markets in the world come online with chocolate and they realize how wonderful it is, it's just going to drive the prices up. So by starting now and making our own chocolate, we're really working on those future relationships.
Is chocolate in the same kind of trouble that coffee is isn't there some blight or something like that going around?
Yes, there's some certainly some issues, but that all stems down to the type of bean you're using and what part of the world you're in. But for me, I love working with beans from Central and South America because you're still dealing with a lot of the or what's left of the Criollo bean, which is probably the one that's most struck with issues and plights. And as the world warms up or cools down, who knows what's happening?
It does both, I think.
We've had 4 out of our last 5 years have been the hottest ever, so I think it's warming up.
That's something.
Yeah.
But no, just getting some great beans from Central and South America, working with farmers and working with co-ops, and making sure the money you spend with me goes directly back to the farmer. That's what I want to see.
That's what you want to see.
Can we talk about these beautiful boxes that are in front of us? You brought a adorable pink box, and inside are a ton of treats, and you brought one for everyone in our audience. So what's in here?
Well, I just wanted to bring a little sampling of some of my favorite things. I mean, people are like, what's your favorite thing to do? And I like to make it all, really. So I put a little sample in there of some of our panned items. This is cranberries and dark chocolate. I believe that's a 68%. I put a few confections in there. One of our favorites is the salt caramel. That's the round one. And there's a little 70% cocoa pod, and that one is made with our Venezuelan cacao. So that you're looking at a 70% and plus cookies, and there's a milk chocolate in there with foyetine in it. I like, you know, being a kid when you got those little Rice Krispie treats in your milk chocolate. Well, this is more of an updated version, more adult. And finally, I think the hardest part of getting this bakery set up and making our own chocolate for all three bakeries as of January, it only took me 2 years to get to that point, but finally getting to that point, you know, we're making chocolate baton for our chocolate croissant. So it's really giving me full control of everything and trying to have fun with. But, yeah, that's what you have in your box. You've got those little sticks. Those are 55%, whereas most pastry chefs and bakeries, they get a chocolate that's a 44%. And so what that basically says is there's a lot more sugar in there. I'm trying to take some of the sugar out.
Right.
So what are you looking for when a chocolate bar just makes your day? You know, you go to the grocery store now, and there's Theo and green and black, and there, I mean the Goba. I mean, there's a million different kinds of this kind of high-end chocolate. Many of them owned by Hershey's now.
Yes.
But what are you looking for personally when you taste the chocolate that makes you smile, look to the heavens? What is it that about that is sending you over? Is it a bitterness level? Is it a floral nature of the bean? What is it that you look for?
Oh, that's a great question. And I'll tell you, I love my chocolate like I love my wine.
Mm-hmm.
Blended.
Blended.
Yeah, I love blends. You know,
yeah, I would think that would be probably the best thing to do. Yeah.
I'm right there with you.
Question,
I love
because I like to drink wine as much as I like to eat chocolate. Mm-hmm. So it's really trying to find those nuances and a balance of flavor. But I'd have to say probably like a 68% is my favorite to eat mm-hmm. on a daily basis. And I do eat chocolate daily. Call it my medicine.
God,
I'm trying to convince others to take their medicine every day too.
Right. And is there a particular couple of varieties? Like in my coffee, I love an aged Sumatra mm-hmm. with a Guatemalan. Like I like that dark, rich base, but
yes.
it's not very acidic. But then I add my acid in with a Guatemalan coffee. So is it the same idea in chocolate?
It can be, but when you start to come to terms with milk chocolate, I love to eat milk chocolate as well. Mm-hmm. Everybody says, oh, no, I only eat the dark chocolate. But they're buying milk chocolate like mm-hmm. there's no tomorrow.
Mm-hmm.
That's just from what I've seen, but
so you just like it all,
yeah. But the milk chocolate, I tell you, it seems to be I get a better flavor profile out of chocolate that is a more inland, less island,
right?
Whereas I want to throw island beans in with something that's a blend that's a 68 or 70, that's a little bit higher, so I get that balance of acidity, caramel, coffee. But a lot of the chocolate that you get that's sort of landlocked, if you will, like Peru or Ecuador or Colombia, you get a lot more chocolate notes, caramel notes, coffee notes. And then depending on the variations, those flavor profiles will change considerably.
Mm-hmm.
How close is it to the ocean? How far is it? And sometimes we get product in, especially from the Amazon, and it's, I swear to you, they take a rake to the jungle floor.
I love that. this is we've been chatting with William Lehman. He's the owner of... A co-owner of Bakery Nouveau locations, now open in Burien, where his lab is making delicious chocolate. Thank you for joining us and sharing your
story. Yeah, thanks so much.
My pleasure.
Up next, Ian Jeffords from Pencove Shellfish is here to talk about some recent shellfish-related food in the news on Cairo Radio 97.3 FM. Welcome back to the Seattle Kitchen Show on Cairo Radio. It's Chef Tom Douglas here.
And Katie O.
And the chef in the chapeau is making his way here as we speak. But instead, we're going to talk to Ian Jeffords from Pencove Shellfish. You have been our shellfish supplier for I don't know how many moons now.
A long time.
Many moons.
We've been very
moons.
Proud of the quality of the work that you guys do. And we serve your products, whether it's the stuff that you distribute. I mean, you don't grow everything that you distribute, right? You do clams and oysters. And
we grow mussels, clams, and oysters, but we also distribute a lot of oysters and clams from other growers that we're affiliated with throughout the area.
So if you ever take a boat up into that Pencove area, you'll see all the mussel rafts.
Pencove and Quilcene Bay.
And Quilcene. I've never been over there.
It's beautiful.
Yeah.
It's a beautiful time. So
lovely.
We'll have to work out a tour.
So you had a scare this last couple of weeks. I don't know if it was Department of Fisheries or state biologists said some mussels here in Elliott Bay at the exit way of the Duwamish River had some issues. And all of a sudden, next thing you know, it blows up into a national story. And the mussels of all over the Northwest are being painted with a brush that you don't particularly care for.
Well... Yeah, that's very true. You know that saying that no good deed goes unpunished. We've worked with the Department of Fish and Wildlife for a number of years, where we take our mussels from Pencove and we put them in little plastic cages, or they do. We donate the mussels, and they have staff that come up, put them in little plastic cages, and then they deposit those little cages of mussels throughout the Puget Sound. And so they put them in industrial waterways like the Duwamish and out here in front of Seattle, over by the shipyard in Bremerton.
Mm-hmm.
And they do that because mussels are filter feeders like our clams and oysters, but they are they're very good at it. So they're a good sentinel species. And they liked using our mussels from Penn Cove because they know that they're clean, they're coming from good water, they've got great baseline data on them, and they can take those cages, put them in polluted waterways, and then use that, use the tissues through chemical analysis to see what is in the water that once it's in the mussel. Unfortunately, the messaging on this last testing episode didn't go quite as we had hoped. Even though the entire story was told by Fish and Wildlife, one of the, as is often the case, they needed to condense the story for many of the news programs. And so instead of saying, hey, these beautifully clean mussels that we get from Whidbey Island are used in this study, and we found by using these mussels, we were able to determine that there are pollutants such as opioids in the Seattle waterfront. Some of that got condensed out, and it was just...
They painted the whole industry with a broad brush.
Yes, right. They did. Imagine that.
I know. Well, it would have been something if it was just local, but then that story went national, and we had a lot of explaining to do, as we like to say, about our system and about the reality of the pristine nature of the mussels from Penn Cove.
So, absolutely. Yeah. I got a lot of interesting texts. Somebody said, you know, I knew I liked your mussels, but I didn't know they were that addictive. And I was like, well, hold on now. So we've had to do a little explaining ourselves, but, the word's gotten out, and, you know, we are very proud to be involved in the program by donating the mussels. It allows fisheries to do these analyses throughout the area because it is a problem. You know, that you think about all of the things that people take in, all sorts of, you know, pharmaceuticals and personal care products that they ingest or use, and then they go out through the wastewater treatment systems that were designed in the 40s and 50s, never intended to, you know, clean these things out. There are means to clean these elements out, but they're not really used in large cities or in industrial size scales yet. There's a great guy, Dr. Lou Lick from the University of Iowa, and he has a company called Ecolotree where they use they call it phytoremediation, and they take wastewater, and you could do it from the treatment plants or from stormwater outlets, and they run it through root systems of these trees that are specially planted, and the roots actually create a bioreactor zone. And so the things like pharmaceuticals, personal care products will bind to roots and soil within this discharge system, and then the microbes in the soil break that down, so you end up with nothing but carbon and water as an output. And so it's a step that Seattle and other metropolitan areas are going to have to go. The systems have been proven on a lot of different areas throughout the country, and now it's taking it the next step. And as Seattle deals with the traffic and has to deal with all the growth, this is one more thing that they're going to have to take into account for the future.
But all in all, this is really a testament to the cleanliness and like the purity of the Penn Cove shellfish, which I think we should just repeat here for everybody.
Well, let's talk about how you grow mussels, because I think people are a little, they see those rafts. I see them when I take my, you know, Lake Union Air or Kenmore Air. You fly over all those rafts, and it's such an interesting process that you've developed out there. Can you just give us the 2-minute capsule on how to grow a mussel?
Sure. So mussels are like other shellfish. You've got males and females, and as the springtime comes along and the water warms up and you get algae growing out in the bay, mussels will become sexually mature and they'll spawn. And when they spawn, eggs and are fertilized in the water. And these fertilized eggs will form a small mussel within less than a 24-hour period. And you have this little larvae swimming around. And after about 3 weeks, it's actually big enough to stick onto something. And so they'll be up in the surface, they'll stick onto something. And in our case, we put down 40 to 50,000 what we call collector lines. We coil these lines up and suspend them in the water from the surface of the raft. The mussel's larvae sticks on these lines, and then later on will open those lines as that larvae begins to grow into what you can see as a small mussel. And that's all occurring right now. If you come up Penn Cove, you'll see these little pepper-sized flakes on these lines starting to show up. And later on in about July or so, that the mussels, they've grown up to about fingernail size. We can thin them out, and we can put those mussels down on the raft. We'd set them out at a proper density throughout the raft. And about a year later, they're large enough to harvest. So we've got a revolving crop all the time going on. We're finishing up one crop, rolling into another. So they take about 12 to 14 months to get big enough to grow, and then we'll harvest that crop for the following year, again starting the next crop, and so on. And so we raise two types of mussels, our pincope mussel and Mediterranean mussels, and we do the same process, but we get that mussel larvae from the hatchery, the Coast Seafoods hatchery up in Quilcene, and we mimic that process in the hatchery, put those lines in the water, and grow those mussels as well.
And is there a type of mussel, you talked about the Mediterranean mussel and the pencove mussel, is there a season for those, or because I always remember the pencove being the cold weather months and the Mediterranean being the warm weather months. Is that not true?
So Mediterranean mussels typically spawn in January or February, and pencove mussels will spawn in late April or May, but they both recover quite quickly. Mm-hmm. So it's more about the type of the mussels, the size of the mussel. Mediterraneans will grow larger. Pencoves are typically served a little smaller. The meat taste is a little bit different, so it's more about personal preference.
Cool. Katie, do you have a favorite mussel recipe?
Ooh, I always like the ones at the palace, actually, that you stick in the fireplace and then all the grilled bread. I think grilled bread, some shellfish, a nice little white wine broth is always my fave. Kind of classic.
Yeah, and you know, it's amazing how much a little bit of smoke flavor they pick up just
really
by being in the open pan in the fireplace.
Mm-hmm.
Kind of shocking. Thanks, Ian. Thanks for talking mussels, and wish you the best on your business.
You betcha, and thank you very much for all your business, Tom.
All right. Up next, we're going to head out to dinner, and a gluten-free one at that, with Tina on Cairo Radio 97.3 FM.
Welcome back to Seattle Kitchen. I'm Tina Knoll, producer of the show, and every once in a while, I get to introduce you to a new spot or bring you along for a foodie adventure. Today, I'm excited to tell you about a new spot in Bothell, Washington, just outside of Seattle. This is of particular interest if you have a food allergy or you're gluten intolerant, and it's tough for you to dine out.
Yeah, we're difficult and high maintenance, and nobody likes it when I have to have them point out what's on the menu and what I can eat and what I can't eat and how they cook it and whether it's contaminated. You know, it's so I often just order things like salads and stuff.
My mom and sister have celiac disease, which causes an autoimmune reaction to eating anything gluten. Gluten's a protein found in wheat and barley and rye, so there's a whole host of things they can't eat. And what's more, even if they get a very mild exposure to wheat, like a crumb of bread, they can get super sick. So no pizza, no bread, no crackers, no pasta. It sucks. So you can imagine how hard it can be for them to eat out in restaurants or enjoy food because they're constantly worried about cross-contamination and getting super sick. So I was really excited when I found a spot in Bothell, Washington, where my sister can eat anything on the menu, and it's run by someone who really gets it.
Gluten is airborne, and once you get exposed to the gluten as a celiac, it's about a 5-week healing process in your gut. So we take that extremely seriously, but a lot of people that dine here don't even know they're eating at a specialty restaurant.
Dusty Du Bois is the owner of Revolve Food & Wine in Bothell, where everything on the menu is celiac-friendly.
I'm going to point out some really fantastic things on this menu that you have not had as a celiac in a long time, like fish and chips. We have buns made with coconut and almond flour. We have crackers. I know. I knew she was going to be really excited. And you'll probably get chills, too, because once you realize that you can have bread pudding, as well, all these things that as a celiac you've given up because of your health, we have reintroduced for you. So I'm so excited, Brett. Yes. So we're going to have some fun with your food tonight. And while we have some spectacular items, like one of my all-time favorite is our 10-ounce, 100% grass-fed New York steak, but that's not what I'm going to direct you to because you have been eating stuff like that. But what you've not been eating is, like I said, the fish and chips, the crackers, the buns, the things that feel like... Yeah, chicken.
I mean, like, not even a consideration. Like, on three different levels, that's, like, not something I could ever consider.
First impressions?
Yum. This crescent mash.
Oh, where's the roll?
Spectacular.
I already have it.
Yeah, and now I'm going to try this sandwich. Oh, God, the bun's really actually nice, and it's got some resistance. It's not like a crispy, weird mushy weirdness. It's like a bun ought to be.
Like a real bun.
It's funny. Can you hear a crunch? Mmm.
So you might wonder, what if you went to this spot but didn't have to eat gluten-free? Would you even like it? And how do they do it anyway? How do you make stuff that's normally full of delicious gluten still taste good? So I asked the chef.
Adam Gerlitz, executive chef at Revolve True Food and Wine in Bottle.
Can I sit? Is that all right?
Yeah, totally. Please.
I think I've earned it today.
Yeah, I bet you had a busy night.
So what we've been doing here is just kind of taking the traditional meals that people normally get at restaurants and having to twist them a little bit because you don't get those typical fillers like your rice and your potatoes and, you know, all those things that we are not allowed to use here. So we've had to come up with creative ways of replacing those. So we use cauliflower rice. We use different root vegetables as a mash or a base or something like that. So when I first came aboard here a year and a half ago plus, it was something to get used to. And, you know, corn, we don't use grain here, so corn starch, anything with corn in it, rice, another big one, you can't use rice flour, so thickening things, trying to use techniques to reduce them down, substitutions such as arrowroot powder versus corn starch to create things that are have that texture in your mouth. So yeah, it's been something to get used to, but it's been fun along the way too, because you learn a lot.
Was there a particular moment or dish that you made that you're like, nailed it, and maybe you thought you weren't going to nail that one?
There have been a lot of those, actually. The Moroccan chicken is really good. It's been very, very popular. The chicken confit that we're doing with the duck fat I think is delicious. It's a good home-cooked, home-feel kind of to it, but it takes a long time to prepare, and but when you get it on the plate, it's got that nice crispy skin, and I think the flavors really go well together. So not the fanciest things in the world. I did try a grass-fed bison heart tartare last week, which surprisingly in Bothell sold pretty well. I was really surprised. I was like, let's just see what happens. And sure enough, people, out of curiosity or actually knew what it was, and, you know, other people would just hear the description and just in disgust look back like, you're serving raw heart to people? But a lot of people really enjoyed it, so it turned out nice.
The chicken sandwich is particularly interesting for someone who has celiac because my sister has celiac, and she's like, nope, I would not have a chicken sandwich. Can't have a chicken sandwich. And you guys have done something really interesting with it. Can you deconstruct that one for me?
Absolutely. So we start with just, you know, we use Mary's organic chicken. It's organic. It's free range. These animals are treated very, very well. It's something that Dr. Dubois has really stressed to us that we want to make sure we're using only humanely raised animals here. So I'm still trying to convince her to do foie gras, but we'll get to that bridge. So then getting back to the chicken sandwich. So we do our own gluten-free burger buns here. We make them from scratch in-house. We then use that in all sorts of applications here. So they turn them into our croutons that go into our Caesar salad. We crush them up, and we use them for breading on things. So when we do the chicken sandwich, we dredge it in the arrowroot flour. We then put it through an egg wash. The arrowroot flour helps it stick to the eggs, stick to the chicken. Or after it's coated in the egg, we then roll it in these crushed gluten-free breadcrumbs that we've created, and then which have been lightly seasoned, of course, give a little extra flavor, and then it's fried. We use safflower oil here, so it fits our niche, I guess. And and then it goes right back onto a gluten-free bun, so it comes full circle. And then we've got a nice Napa slaw in there with some honey Dijon dressing that we make. All of our mayonnaise and ketchups and all of our sauces are made in-house. So there's a bit of a stigma attached to the gluten-free, grain-free eating lifestyle, but what we found here is that, especially with our latest menu, we're able to appeal to a larger group of people. People that do have celiac can come in here. They can bring their families, and no one leaves dissatisfied or having to stop at McDonald's on the way home.
Totally.
So, and they don't even miss the potatoes and the rice. We want this to be the spot to come and to eat, not just because we're gluten-free, celiac safe. We want people to come here because the food is so good.
I'm here to tell you, the food is really that good. So if you want to treat somebody that you love to a non-gluten delicious meal, head out to Revolve Food & Wine in Bothell, Washington. For more, go to our Facebook page, Seattle Kitchen. I posted some pictures and a whole bunch of other stuff. Happy eating. You're listening to Seattle Kitchen on Cairo Radio 97.3 FM.
Welcome back. It's the Seattle Kitchen Show. Tom Douglas here.
Jerry Rocher, the chef in a hat.
Hey, Katie O.
I guess I'm the chef without a chapeau.
Yes.
That's right. You do not have a hat, but you have a lovely, lovely head of hair.
You're the chef with curly hair.
You know, I'm turning 60 this year.
What are you going to do to celebrate?
Well, Italy, I don't know. Do you have any thoughts?
Yeah, I thought you were going to Italy.
Everybody, no, I'm going to a rosé party on the deck at Cuoco.
That's basically like going to Italy.
There you go.
Yeah, I'll make it feel like that.
There you go.
Good.
Nikki Koff is here. She runs the wine program and is assistant manager over at Cuoco Restaurant. I just said it the way people say it. I said Cuoco, and it's not. It's Cuoco.
Cuoco.
C-U-O-C-O.
Yes, to cook Cuoco. In Italian, yeah.
Cook. Not to cook.
But sorry, cook.
Cook.
Yes.
And you know what two cooks are in Italian? Cuochi.
Oh, nice.
Yeah, see? Who knew?
Do tell us what you guys do at Cuoco, because I think not enough people know about that restaurant. It's a fantastic restaurant. Mm-hmm. Do beautiful homemade pasta. Do tell the rest of the story.
Well, I think you've done most of it right there.
I just think it's a cool restaurant.
Yeah,
it's
walk right into the pasta kitchen when you walk into Cuoco. And we do all sorts of things. Obviously, we do steaks and lamb and
lots of pasta dishes.
And
yeah, I think originally, I mean, the history of Cuoco, from what I've heard, is that, you know, it started off as a Piemontese house. Mm-hmm. So the pasta, the food, the cuisine was really trying to embody a lot of that, you know, Northwestern style Italian food. Now we look at, you know, Sicily, we're looking into Alto Adige and looking to see what everybody's doing, what's fresh, what's new, and doing our rustic modern spin on Italian cuisine.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so. I've always had delicious food there. It's really cool.
Well, thank you. I think it's a beautiful restaurant. You know, yeah. It's an old brick building on Terry Avenue and Harrison Street. Old brick building, and it's right in the middle of the block, courtyard, and have some outdoor dining. Unfortunately, right now they're building a hotel. I mean, fortunately, but unfortunately.
Yes.
So
luckily, they stop a lot of the construction during lunch, mm-hmm. and then for that happy hour time period. So they're being very considerate.
That's nice. Okay, so Nikki, tell us about your rosé on the patio.
Yeah, so this started last year, and it was just as a fun way to get people to come and check out our patio, mm-hmm. to see what our happy hour is like, to kind of get a taste of what Cuoco does.
Mm-hmm.
After last year, it was just such a big hit that we decided to do like a four-part series this year. So we're starting on June 15th for our first series, and we have one in July, August, and September. And it's five glasses of rosé from all sorts of regions of Italy, paired with some snacks that Ron has made. And if you were here last year, he's planning on doing a whole different thing, mm-hmm. this year. Mm-hmm. So it's always going to be a new experience. So even if you decide to come to all four, you'll have a great time. You'll try different wines, different snacks. And we're always trying to do something new and creative and fun to kind of match, you know, the vibe that's going on in South Lake Union, mm-hmm. right now. Because
so
it's changed so much.
In the rosé, are you going from north all the way to South Italy?
We thought about doing that. But, you know, it's more fun to add variety because I really want to highlight different styles of rosés.
Uh-huh.
So I'd love to do like a dry rosé, a rosé with a lot of minerality, a lot of fruit. We're going to have a couple of sparkling rosés, and as you know, I mean, from Italy, sure. There's not a lot of variety that you can get, especially if you do like 100% Nebbiolo all across the board.
Right.
It might not be as fun, mm-hmm. so I wanted to showcase a lot of different styles to go with the food that we have.
Right.
So.
Well, that's excellent.
Yeah.
My favorite rosé from Italy, I don't know if it's available this year or not, but I love that Castella d'Amma rosé. It's a Tuscan Chianti maker, you know.
I have not had it,
yeah.
actually.
Somebody, I'm not sure who carries it now, but Cavatappi used to carry that,
okay.
that wine, but I love that Castella d'Amma rosé, and I had it there at the winery with the a chicken that was roasted in the fireplace, just
yum.
Salt and pepper chicken over the live fuel, just twirling on a wire, you know, just spinning around because of the heat.
That sounds so good.
Oh, it's so good. I had it with a little rabolita, a little bread, Italian bread soup, and it was delicious. And that was a monumental lunch that this lady, and she was a German lady. She wasn't Italian, but she was an awesome cook.
She knew her way around the kitchen, yeah. though, which was the
you
most
don't really
important
expect
part.
That at a winery. It's not like mm-hmm. it's a restaurant. They just kind of cook for the guest of the winery, and
That's awesome. Yeah, we have a lot of really great rosés on our wine menu right now. In general, I'm just so geeked out about our wine menu because we're doing different things that I think most restaurants aren't,
mm-hmm.
which is showcasing these beautiful, really high-quality wines for the price that, like, you might not even find, or maybe only is poured by the bottle. And I'm always trying to look for new or cool, like, small grower winemakers mm-hmm. in Italy. So, like, right now we've got this really awesome Valpolicella blend for a rosé. And I know you're not a big fan of Amarone, but it's got...
Valpolicella isn't... Yeah, I mean, it's...
Yeah, it's Amarone got a lot of great fruit.
A different animal. Yes. Yeah,
yeah, mm-hmm. but it's got a lot of really great fruit coming from Veneto, and my staff is super excited about it. They've never had this style of rosé mm-hmm. before, and it's fun when you can go into a restaurant that everybody is just so excited to sell the wine, to sell the events. We just had a Negroni event last week that mm-hmm. was super fun. So, a lot of fun stuff at Cuoco. So, if you've never been, you know, it's not just really fine dining. You can also have a really great time for mm-hmm. our happy hour, for just a glass of wine, some snacks, small bite of pasta. So,
well, and this is a really great opportunity. We always talk about taste comparisons, and I yeah. think there's not a ton of instances where you can spend so little and get so much back in terms mm-hmm. of getting to try a wide variety and really finding out like what it is that you like, because there are so many different styles, and it's hard to know just tasting one-offs.
Yes.
But having something back to back with some nibbles, what a fun way to spend.
It's a great way to develop your palate,
yeah.
you know,
yeah.
and have some extended knowledge of, you know, what wine tastes like and what different wine tastes like. So it's
yes.
cool.
So in the five varietals, will there be things like, okay, a Sangiovese rosé, a Pinot Noir rosé? You're going to go across the board.
Yes. Yeah. So right now for the first rosé event, we have what I said, the Valpolicella rosé, Sor Corvina. We've got a Nebbiolo rosé. We do have a La Crema sparkling mm-hmm. rosé that we're going to be featuring as well. We have 100% Sangiovese sparkling as well, Montepulciano rosé. So there's a lot of really different varieties, mm-hmm. and I'm hoping for the next one, I'll be looking to different grape varietals from maybe Sicily. Maybe we'll do like a Nerello Mascalese rosé mm-hmm. or something like that. So
yeah,
a lot of really good stuff in there too. Especially with all of the bright spring.
Well, just
like
when you say
food.
Sicily, I'm thinking Taormina. I'm sitting on the
Nero di Avola, yeah.
What do I want?
Yeah. Nikki, what do you think of the trend of frosé?
You know, I was actually in New York recently,
mm-hmm.
and if it's done right, it's really tasty.
Mm-hmm.
You definitely have to add a lot more, you know, sweetener, fruit, and everything like that. So it's not just the
straight
actual
rosé.
Embodiment of rosé,
yeah.
you know. So I think it's fun, you know.
Maybe you can explain what it is.
I haven't had it either, but I see it on menus quite a bit, and even at Bottle House, which is kind of a little wine bar near where do I live, and it's just like what you kind of think it is, which
yeah,
is a slushy rosé, but mm-hmm. it seems very popular. I see it on a
yes.
lot of people's tables wherever it's served. So,
well, I think slushies in general, you know, when you have that beautiful patio summer vibe, mm-hmm. you want that. So,
yeah, something nice,
you know,
and cool.
If you go to Brave Horse, they have all sorts of different like slushies, but they definitely have a frozen.
Isn't it funny all the different trends that happen in restaurants?
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
I mean, it wasn't 40 years ago when this whole frozen margarita thing happened mm-hmm. in taverns around the country, and now you find them in fine dining restaurants. It's just kind of wacky.
Well, I was surprised with the Negroni party. We did a rhubarb green apple sorbet with a float of Negroni on top.
Ooh, yeah.
Now that's my kind of frosé.
Yeah.
It's like not something that's pre-mixed. You just put the alcohol
yeah,
on top.
That seems great.
Why bother having two plates?
It was
delicious.
Put
everything in one
yeah.
cup.
It was definitely our most popular. So
I would suggest going to see Nikki Koff, the Rosé on the Patio event at Cuoco. It's June 15th, July 20th, August 17th, and September 21st. Tickets are $25 a person in advance, $30 at the door, and they are available at TomDouglas.com.
Yeah, such
and
a great deal.
I believe they all sold out last year.
Yes. Mistaken. Yeah, I believe her first
$25 they should set up.
Oh, it's such a great deal, definitely. Yeah.
Thanks
you
for coming.
Check it out. Yeah, of course. Thank you for having me.
All right, up next, pastry chef Brittany Bartleben is whipping up some tasty Father's Day treats, and we're going to hope that you join us on Cairo Radio 97.3 FM. Welcome back to the Seattle Kitchen. It's time for the Baker's Corner.
Yeah!
Chef Brittany Bartleben from the Dahlia Bakery is here. And we're going to talk about some things that you might make for Father's
yeah.
Day.
Yeah.
And then we had a fight yesterday. Brittany and I had a fight
About what?
And I want to apologize. I was totally out of line. I called her in the question because there was a passion fruit tart as our seasonal pastry at the Dahlia Bakery yesterday when
mm-hmm.
I was having lunch at the Dahlia.
Mm-hmm.
And I was thinking, dang, I thought it was strawberry season. How can we have
not
passion
yet.
Fruit?
Oh,
yes,
today.
So yeah. There she was with strawberries behind her back and said, dude, I got this.
Yeah, maybe slow your roll for a second.
Yeah, slow your roll, man. Yeah.
They literally were available that day. Yeah. But it is strawberry season now, guys. Yay! Which is very exciting. Yay!
So just so you don't feel so bad, yesterday I made a pavlova with passion fruit mousse and green strawberry macerated.
Ooh.
You too can be out of season. Yeah. That's awesome.
I am not great. Out of season. I'm totally in season. You don't make a pavlova without passion fruit. Jeez.
Well, so I found out. Yeah.
What? Do you want to stick on this?
No.
Okay, let's move on to the strawberries.
I want to move forward.
Me too, because it is really an exciting season. I know that I personally just like lose my mind. I always want them on the counter because they're so delicious.
Yes.
And we're coming into Father's Day, which Tom pointed out earlier in the show is a great time to use the fruit that's now coming into season, be it strawberries or cherries.
Yes.
What? I mean, everyone kind of knows the shortcake. That's a very easy go-to recipe for most people. But what do you love to do with strawberries? Maybe it is shortcake.
Why didn't you tell her what the beautiful, delicious shortcake tricks that I said in the very first segment?
It was a black pepper shortcake, right?
With brown butter.
With brown butter. Mm. And then macerated strawberries with a little anise hyssop.
Yes.
Oh, lightly anise hyssop. Macerated. You had me at anise hyssop. God. That... Yeah.
Yep. Okay. You're there.
Yep.
Now you can come in second at this point.
Yes.
She's just confirming what you said, Tom.
With strawberries, especially for Father's Day, I want to do something simple. First of all, let's dispel the myth that fathers just want a barbecue. Yes, they want a barbecue, but that doesn't mean you can ignore dessert. This is a really great time to make dessert. Mm-hmm. I love a pound cake with strawberries for Father's Day. Mm-hmm. Also for Father's Day, my dad personally loves berry pie, and so this is a really good time to actually use up any leftover berries from last year
from the freezer
to clear it out, and because there's going to be all sorts of stuff coming up here pretty soon, and so you're going to want a FIFO, which is first in, first out, little industry term. You're going to want to move out that old stuff. So that's what I do, is I make last year's berry pie, because usually the Marion berries and the blackberries, they're not quite ready yet.
Right.
Also, my dad personally, he's a brunch guy, and not going out to brunch. He wants to make his own brunch. So I always make our biscuits, our buttermilk biscuits from the Dahlia Bakery cookbook.
Ooh.
And that's also a wonderful thing. Those also double as a great shortcake.
They do great with strawberry.
Yeah, you make a batch of them in the morning, have them for breakfast with gravy, and then that evening
What's the trick to making a delicious buttermilk biscuit? Because I think people get a little bit nervous at the idea, thinking that they're maybe
a
little temperamental.
Yeah, they're not. They're so easy. Mm-hmm. Cold butter, it's just like pie crust, and you just want to gently knead them. When you've got your dough come together, you dump it out on your bench or your table, and then you just kind of fold it over itself once. And that's going to produce the tender biscuit and layers that you're looking for as well.
Yes, because that is the coveted experience, right? That hot, warm biscuit with all those little layers inside.
Yeah.
Delicious.
How about trifle? Do you make strawberry trifle kind of idea?
Sometimes, yeah. Yeah, my dad's not really a trifle guy, so I don't make it for Father's Day. But, yeah, I do love a good
But I think the other secret about you, is this true that I'm recalling this correctly? You're not a big fan of cooked strawberries.
No, I hate cooked strawberries. No, hate's a strong word. I'm not a fan.
Hate is strong, but
I don't like
maybe
them baked.
It's true.
My mom would say I'm not so keen on it.
I'm not so keen. I like that. That's much more ladylike. Mm-hmm. They sort of turn this milky pink color. I don't think their flavor is especially enhanced. This is when they're incorporated into a baked good. Mm-hmm. Now, if you take some strawberries and roast them at a super high temperature and maybe drizzle a little balsamic over it, that's a totally different story.
Right.
I'm really into that. But putting them in a muffin or something
like
that. I'm
with you. I'm not a big fan of baked
strawberry. I don't think
either.
It does anything for the strawberry.
I like strawberry soup in red wine. It was something as a child when I grew up. Not to say that we were young kids and drinking wine, but
you were.
In this case, you know, a little red wine in macerated strawberries, a little vanilla and a little sugar, and then some fresh cheese curd.
Oh, that sounds delicious.
Oh, it was so delicious.
I do really like strawberries and red wine together. It makes a really nice, if you're going to make a strawberry coulis or something, add a little red wine.
It's very savory, but it's delicious.
Yeah, it's really nice.
Chopped chives right on top of that. I like
just
that.
Just taking this all in, my father was a strawberry nut. He would eat a whole flat of strawberries.
Just raw?
Of course he would excuse himself.
Yes, I was going to say, that sounds like a stomach ache.
No, he just loved them. He couldn't stop.
Yeah.
So,
nature's candy.
We often had strawberry shortcake.
Yeah.
So let's go back to the biscuit for a second, because I think of those buttermilk biscuits mm-hmm. that we do as being a little tougher than, say, a shortbread would be.
They are. They definitely are. And some people like them that way.
Not a shortbread. Shortcake.
Shortcake, exactly. Yeah. They're not as tender. Uh-huh. They do have the layers that you're maybe looking for. Mm-hmm. A shortcake doesn't have those layers. And this is going to be more, if you're not so much of a sweets person, they have a little bit of that salty, buttery element that a shortcake
The shortcake has the sugar, it has the crumb that, in my mind, that soaks up the
juices
a little
right.
bit differently and cuts a little bit differently with your fork. It's a little more tender to cut. And
But, you know, whipped cream and berries is it's all a vehicle for that.
I was going to say, I just need something to put all that goodness on top.
If you forget to make the biscuit, it's still good.
Yes. Yeah.
So this is the time of year where we finally get to put rhubarb to bed, even though people insist on marrying it with strawberries, which I don't quite get personally. But we are heading into dream season, right?
My job is so easy.
Right after the strawberries, we get hit by cherries. And then we're right into blackberries and
all the stones
and apricots.
We are heading into dream season.
And at the same time, we're getting these beautiful herbs that you mentioned earlier: anise hyssop, sweet Sicily. I mean, tarragon is really delicious with berries. Mm-hmm.
Basil.
Basil obviously is great with anything sweet. Yeah, it's a really fun time.
I love it. I love thinking about it. I love waiting on the peaches until they're perfect. Yes. And we have a little orchard at our farm, and you can just walk right up to it, right? They're kind of dwarfed trees, and you just put your hand around the peach, and
you can feel it.
We just netted
heat coming off of it.
Yeah, I know. You really can because it's 105 degrees out there. You can feel it radiating the heat. You always have to pick.
I think all city dwellers need to take a trip to the countryside and go to a peach tree and pick a ripe peach so they can understand what that is.
Right.
Because I think a lot of people don't know. They just don't know. They've never been faced with it, but if you've ever had a ripe strawberry picked right off the ground where it's like almost breaking
warm
in your fingers.
Yeah.
Or if you've ever picked a peach that's like seriously like it's got the dew of the morning on it and it's so tender and you just want to eat it right there.
It's so poetic.
Yeah. I mean, it's once you've had that once in your life, you never forget. You just go, this is what I'm looking for every time.
Last year, Jackie, Tom's wife, brought me a tote of, I don't know, it was maybe a dozen nectarines from Prosser that she had just picked, brought over, and they were literally wrapped in a baby blanket. Mm-hmm. And they were the most delicious nectarines I've ever had in my life. I'm going to have to bug her this year. Make sure I get
they
one.
They just drip that. They're
bricks.
The syrup.
I actually tested the bricks on one of them, and it was like in the upper 30s.
I so look forward to that. To finish with strawberries, a simple dessert outside of shortcake. I think everyone understands shortcake. I like to make a little tart, like a little tart shell, a little creme or pastry cream, or even something a little firmer than that, because I don't like when the weight of the strawberries forces the cream out the side. So how do you what do you do? Just make it thicker?
Just make it thicker and maybe chill it before putting the strawberries on top so that cream gets a chance to set and sort of cure in that in that shell.
Right.
Yeah.
And then there's always, you know, in bad bakeries, there's always a bad glaze on top.
Yes.
What is a good glaze? How do you make a good glaze?
So, is when you make an actual real apricot glaze. So
you take apricot jam?
Apricot jam, or we're poaching apricots right now and saving the syrup, and we're just reducing that. That's a great glaze.
It's what you do. You can do that with strawberry, too. You can macerate your strawberries in sugar. And the syrup that comes out, you take that syrup and you intensify it by reducing it down a little bit. Once it's cooled off, you just drizzle that all over your tart.
So that has a natural pectin in it.
Yes,
then,
totally.
Right?
Yes, exactly.
So it'll give you the glaze.
Yeah.
Because that is just a horrific. You see all that beautiful fruit layered on the top of the tart.
And then this gloopy glaze.
You bite into glue on top. Yeah. So.
Do we have time for me to talk about what I brought for you guys today?
Yes.
So I brought you brittle daddle, or I'm sorry, fiddle daddle. That's what we're calling it. It's like fiddle faddle. It is caramel corn that we added our Rub With Love Peri Peri mix to, corn nuts, candied walnuts, and some Bavarian meats, Landjäger sausage.
What? There's sausage in there?
Yeah.
That is a fiddle faddle.
It's
fiddle daddle.
Yeah, it's something that goes really well with beer, and we're going to offer it for Father's Day and at the Dahlia Lounge for the dads.
Oh my gosh,
Father's Day.
Nice.
Lovely.
Yeah.
I'm a father.
Saying. Yeah.
Up next, thank you, Brittany Bartleben.
Thank
you. Up next, Food for Thought, Tasty Trivia on Cairo Radio 97.3 FM. Happy Father's Day.
Happy Father's Day.
Welcome back. It's the Seattle Kitchen Show here at the Hot Stove Society. If you want to buy tickets to the show, simply go to hotstovesociety.com. $15 later, you get a breakfast sandwich, delicious company on a lovely Tuesday morning.
All you can drink coffee.
All you can drink coffee. It's a great, great place to be alive.
And how is that sandwich?
William Lehman has stayed with us to do the Food for Thought Tasty Trivia Challenge. And Katie's going to tell us how it all works.
That's right. William, thank you for staying with
us. My pleasure.
You kind of got wrangled into this, but let me tell you the rules. What you're going to do is each person is going to get 5 trivia questions. Whoever gets the most is obvious correct is obviously the winner, and whoever gets the least amount correct has to give something away to one of our listeners. Today, it is Jean Parton Russell. She had a 3-part question about mayonnaise earlier in the show. So that is who we are going to play for. Tom Douglas, if you lose today, what will you give away?
You know, it's hot times in the Pike Place Market right now, and our joints down there are cooking because we have outdoor dining. So I'm going to give away a $100 gift card to Sea Town Restaurant.
Ooh,
maybe you get a chance to sit outside, watch the market hustle and bustle.
Have a little shrimp cocktail.
Mm-hmm.
Sounds like a great time.
Chicken pot pie.
That's right. Mm-hmm. Terry Rotero, what will you give away should you lose today?
I'm going to give brunch for two on Father's Day at Luke.
All right. William Lehman of Bakery Nouveau. I don't know that anyone warned you properly that if you're playing this game that you'd have to give something away, but should you lose today, what will you give away to our fine listener?
I brought 10 different chocolate bars from the new selection. 11, yes, thank you. So that's what I have to offer.
All right, who would like to go first on the quiz?
I'll start.
All right, this question is pretty much made for you.
Uh-oh.
At an elegant French banquet, you might see a large pyramid of cream-filled puff pastries covered with a glistening golden glaze of spun sugar. What's that called?
Croquembouche.
That is correct.
That was all. William, I'm glad you didn't get that.
I know. William's like, why couldn't that have been my question?
He's like, wait a minute, I'll make those.
Here's the next one. This is a little bit, maybe a little bit more obscure. The Eskimo diet is intended to protect the heart by consumption of, is it A, fish fat and cholesterol, B, whale blubber, C, polar bear meat, or D, seal meat?
Meat. I'm going to go with the seal meat, no?
Seal meat? No. What we were looking for was fish fat and cholesterol. The rate of heart attack of Greenland Eskimos is 10% that of the U.S. adults. So that's because of the high concentration
baby.
Of
fish.
No, it's because they get eaten by polar bears when they're 12 years old.
Oh, is that what it is? Yeah. I don't know. That doesn't seem based in fact. It seems like alternative facts.
All right.
All right. Your third question, Terry. A famous French West Indies fish preparation is named for the sound a whole fish makes when it is dropped into a pot of boiling water. The name and the sound is what? I'll give you some options. A, cush. B, clop. C, blaff. Or D, zets.
What's the first one?
Cush.
I'm going to go with that.
We do only have a certain time limit.
That is incorrect. It's actually blaff. Blaff is what we were looking
for. All right.
For.
Well, right? We learned something.
A little tricky. Your fourth question, Terry. Wine crystals on a cork indicate what? A, it's corky. B, no. The wine has not been cold stabilized. C, it's high in tannins. Or D, it's low in acids.
High in tannins.
It's actually B. The wine has not been cold stabilized. These crystals, usually tartaric acid, are a good sign that the wine has not been over-treated.
What?
Your last question, Terry. A wine's legs are what? Here are some options. Length of the finish. Is it the streaks appearing in the glass when the wine is swirled?
Yes.
Is it... Okay. Yes, you are correct. That's nice. Terry, that is 2 out of 5. Not completely
William,
shut out, not too
welcome
terrible.
Welcome to the show.
I'm so sorry.
Yeah, I'm so sorry, too.
All right, Tom or
we
William, who would like to go next?
We might get those chocolate bars after all. William.
Yeah, William, go.
All right, here you go. Your first question, balut, a popular street food in the Philippines, is what? Is it a 2-week-old soft-boiled duck embryo? Is it fried grasshoppers? Is it tiny worm-like eels?
Mm-hmm.
Or is it congealed snake blood?
Oh, it's got to be that.
Wow, that's far out.
All delicious sounding.
I'm going to go with grasshoppers.
It's actually the 2-week-old soft-boiled duck embryo.
Okay.
Yeah, they just sell them on the streets. Tasty, tasty.
Can't wait.
Yeah. All right. Here's your next question. Which fermented beverage has the highest level of alcohol? Is it beer, wine, sake, or cider?
I'm going to say sake.
That is correct. Very nice.
Yeah.
Ooh.
Oh, boy.
Audience
man.
Is on
I'm
your side right now.
Every
man,
week.
That's good team. Teamwork.
We know whose side they're on.
He's one answer, he gets applause.
Yeah.
Wow.
All right, William, your third question. An antioxidant substance in this food helps digestion, kills bacteria, reduces risk of blood clots. Is it molasses, hot peppers, chocolate, or Dr. Pepper?
Oh, chocolate.
Of course.
That would be a good answer for you, but unfortunately, it's actually hot peppers. The capsaicin also helps production of intestinal antibodies, is a pain blocker, and an anti-inflammatory.
I'll stick with chocolate.
I know.
I stick with chocolate, too.
You could probably combine the two, though. Make a little spicy chocolate situation. All right. Your fourth question, the pavlova, a dessert made in honor of Anna Pavlova, is made in the shape of a, is it a dancer's tutu, barking dog, chef toque, or Egyptian obelisk?
It's a chef toque.
It's actually the dancer's
tutu.
The tutu.
Okay.
The tutu. All right, William, your final question. The word trocken on a German wine label means, does it mean white, drunken, dry or sparkling?
Drunken.
It's actually dry.
Oh. Thank God he's
I'm
got
fired.
Chocolate.
I gotta go now.
You're not
oh,
going
no.
anywhere.
Oh
no,
you gotta wait till Tom is down.
You gotta
I
wait
could,
to
I
see what's going
you.
On with Tom.
Yeah, I can outdo you.
All right, Tom Douglas, here we go. Your five questions. This widely used herb may lower blood sugar and increase glucose tolerance as well as lowering blood fat. Is it thyme, sage, coriander, or parsley?
I'll go with parsley.
That is incorrect, coriander. Sir. It's coriander. Your second question, Tom. The Spanish braised beef dish, ropa vieja, translates as, is it old rope, old clothes, old meat, or mean old woman?
Well, I've never braised a mean old woman. So I'm going to say old rope.
Actually, old clothes.
Old clothes.
Old clothes. All right, Tom, your third question. The mouthfeel quality of wine known as grip is contributed by what? Is it alcohol, sugar, acid, or tannins?
Tannins.
That is correct.
Yes.
Very nice. You're on the board.
Woo.
Fourth question. The Mexican stew called menudo is considered a good hangover cure. What is the main meat in it?
Tripe.
That is correct. Beef
yes.
tripe is the right answer. And Tom, your final question, fining enhances wine clarity. The traditional additive for this purpose is ground fish protein, whipped egg whites, oak chips, or live bacteria.
So I'm going to go with the bacteria.
It is actually egg whites,
it's
Tom.
Egg whites.
That's 2 out of 5.
Didn't we have a tie ball game, all of us?
No.
Sadly
enough. Sorry, William.
I don't know about this game. This is rigged. Who chose these questions?
It does feel a little bit rigged.
This is a very low-scoring game.
Okay,
2-2-1.
Yes, Gene Parton Russell gets all 11 beautiful, beautiful chocolate bars that are made over at Bakery Nouveau. These beautiful peacock-labeled chocolates. We should take a picture.
Thank you, William Lehman. We'll put that on our website.
Yeah,
if you want to be part
thanks
of our show, you can send us a note on Facebook or Twitter at Seattle Kitchen. You're listening to us on Cairo Radio 97.3 FM. This show is produced by Tina Knoll at Large Media. Our associate producer is Sarah Leibovitz, and our sound engineer doing a fine job is Sean Don't Call Me Del Torre. If you'd like to become part of our studio audience, go to hotstovesociety.com and fork up $15 to buy a ticket. And remember, if you miss any episode of Seattle Kitchen, you can subscribe to our podcast through Apple, Stitcher, or download the Cairo Radio app and search for Seattle Kitchen.
Thanks for listening.
Have a great weekend.